Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa, no mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak up, kōrerotia. Tune in as our guests speak up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right.
Kia ora, ko speak up kōrerotia tēne, ko sāle kalta nā hou. Today we are thinking about the right to protest, which is a fundamental human right. It's one that we're seeing being enacted at the moment to a huge degree. I feel like we're seeing so many protests right around the world. But on the flip side, we're also seeing governments trying to enact legislation that try to counter or diminish or put regulations around some of these protests. So I think it's a really pertinent topic and it's a really timely one to be addressing at the moment. We're going to be thinking about some of the particular contexts in which we've seen a lot of protests recently and what that might mean. We have three guests and you all come to this conversation from really different angles. So I'm really excited to hear about each of you and your mahi and why you're really passionate about this topic. Lisa, let's start with you.
I'm Lisa. I'm from Amnesty International Aotearoa New Zealand. And the right to protest is really core to the mahi that we do now and has been ever since we began. As you were saying, like in that global context of authoritarian creep that we're seeing, it is so important, the ability to come together. And that's why a core focus for us is on the right to protest, because when we come together, that's how we're going to push back against repressive regimes taking hold. It's that idea by working together, we can turn the tide on human rights regression and build the type of society that we all want to live in. That's why that right to protest is so fundamental and so important, and why we're seeing so many people come together at the moment, because they do want to push back against authoritarian practices. They do want to resist human rights regression.
Yeah, very true. I feel like particularly off the back of a year or two of a lot of protesting for Palestine in particular, there's just so much of it at the moment. And Farah, it would be lovely to hear from you, please.
Yeah, kia ora, everyone. My name is Farah. And I'm originally from Iran. I'm a migrant. I came to New Zealand 11 years ago as a skilled migrant. My background is back in Iran, was in education. I was a university lecturer in New Zealand. I'm doing various things. I work as an interpreter, and I'm also doing some governance work, being a member of a couple of boards. And I've been involved with former refugees and migrants. And this topic of right to protest is very, very important for me because, you know, as an Iranian, I grew up really with protests. You know, we were protesters as we were growing up. And I witnessed the power of protests in making change, even in the most authoritarian regimes. So, yeah, I've been part of the protests growing up myself. And then I decided to move to New Zealand. But even here as diaspora of Iranian diaspora, we are still trying to show our solidarity with the protesters in Iran. So, and I really worried about the right to protest gradually disappearing in democratic countries like New Zealand. So this is a big concern for me.
Thanks, Farah. And we'll hear more about what's happening in Iran as we progress with the show. And our final guest, Peter.
Yes, hi. Thank you. And it is a delight to be here with my three colleagues. I'm the head of humanities here at the University of Canterbury. And I have an expertise particularly in American history. But as the academic here, I guess my first statement would be the opposite of anything academic, which is there are many people to this day in Iran and other places who are putting themselves at risk and on the line in protest. And so our academic discussion, I think, is always one that follows on from acknowledging those people like Fada in a previous era, who are putting their lives on the line at the moment in protest. So always aware that when we engage in academic discussions and gesture 23 centuries in the past and talk about American constitutional niceties, et cetera, that we remind ourselves that this academic argument is in the context of those who are putting their lives on the line.
I think you raise a really great point, Peter, which is that protests can be something that is not safe. And I think that one thing that we perhaps don't think about so much is that it's not just dependent on where you are, but who you are as well. Certain groups can be safer or less safe taking part in protests than others.
Yeah, so maybe we would start with Fada. How many Iranians probably lost their lives in the last 3 weeks at the hands of their own regime, their own government, their own people?
Yeah. So we don't know. The numbers are not known due to the blackouts, internet blackouts, because most of the killings happened in 2 days. And internet was shut down for 2 weeks. The regime has announced 3,000 and some, but the numbers like are at least 10 times as much based on several sources. So, yes, yeah, so many people got killed, and the regime used live ammunition. Truly, you know, my own family members back home, they were actually witnessing, even from the like safety of their homes, from an apartment building, they say that they were shooting at people's windows if they were like protesting. So yeah, so many people have died. But yeah, I don't want to talk too much. But yeah, the thing is, as I told you, I grew up with protests, and we have, because we had to come up with new ways of protesting, us Iranians and maybe a lot of other people, we have various ways of protesting, from chanting on rooftops to burning headscarves to like strikes. Of course, the strikes are, you are very familiar with. But yeah, we have very innovative ways of protesting, although we are technically deprived of those rights.
But it'll be great to hear more about this. I think that's a really interesting point. I was actually just having a conversation with someone the other day around protest, and they said something along the lines that they've never taken part in a protest, because to them, protest was marching or taking part in a protest down the street. But actually, protest is so many and can be so many different things. Mm. And when we talked about it, they realized actually that protest was actually a big part of their life, really, in a way they hadn't realized, that there are really creative and different ways to protest and that they are impactful. So I'd love to hear more about that from what you were saying.
Yeah, just if you want to know innovative ways, like from burning hijab, cutting hair in public. Yeah, women have been doing things like that, or even just walking, you know, because the right to whatever cover you want to choose, you know, we did not have that, although they are being more lenient recently. But yeah, people just walking unveiled on the street is a form of protest for us. Or videoing, women have been, even dancing in public is a form of protest. And recently, very, very interestingly, in funerals, mothers, fathers, they have been dancing at the grave of their children to show that they are still resisting. And the dancing is not part of our like mourning rituals. It has never been. But now people are playing music, dancing, showing that, you know, they are going to continue. And funerals are very, very important places for us to show protest. And in a lot of cases, some funerals are always disrupted by the forces because they know that's one place where people, feel free, or somehow they feel more courageous to show their dissent. So yeah, we boycotting election boycotting is another way that we do it. Even the diaspora protests, us Iranians outside of Iran, you know, for example, this coming Saturday, we want to show our solidarity with the people of Iran. That's why we are gathering in city centers in different cities, because there are millions of Iranians living outside of Iran. This is another way of showing our protest to this regime. So yeah, we have become very creative.
It'd be interesting to hear from you, all of you, about the way that the internet might be playing into creative or different or new ways of protest.
I think it's definitely been an incredible innovation in allowing people to come together and allowing different voices to come to the fore. And I think that potential continues. But there is also the flip side to what we're seeing in the online world, which is actually creating barriers for some people to be able to safely have a say in society. Because essentially the way many online platforms are designed, it's meaning and how the algorithms are working, it's creating a really unsafe environment for a lot of people. And when we, a couple of years ago, went out into communities and asked what is barriers to protest, and one of the things that makes it harder for you to participate in society, online harm came up, particularly amongst young people, and the fear of having a say, and then as a result, facing huge attacks online. And we know so many activists who have had to step back because of that. So I think when we're talking about the right to protest and what needs to be done, the regulation of online platforms that we've seen overseas, and I don't at all mean the banning of social media for young people, because that doesn't address the root causes. I'm thinking more about the acts that's been in the EU and the UK that create a regime where tech companies have to be accountable and transparent, carry out a duty of care. There are penalties for non-compliance and so forth. So I think the potential and the benefits of the online world, there is so much there, and we know it is a critical space for people to come together, especially when it might not be safe in person areas. So it is such an important space, but also work needs to be done to make sure it's safer for everyone.
I really couldn't emphasize more what Lisa said, that there are two sides here. One is the one we obviously think of as anyone who has a phone or a computer has access to other people who have the same, or has everyone has a camera so they can take pictures and upload them, so that there seems to be a remarkable democratization or opportunity for democratization of information. But it is, in fact, the risk of that and the response to that that I think is one of the great risks to the right of protest and the right of speech and the right of communication. So regimes which want to hold on to power are very busy ensuring, I don't think the safety or unsafety per se of individuals, but rather monopolizing information and trying to restrict it. To me, that's the great new danger to rights of protest, is regimes, whether it's the UK, the United States, in democratic regimes that are, or folks like me, actually, folks in the intellectual class, the ones who used to have a monopoly on saying what is true and not true, I've lost that to the world through the democratization of the internet, and I think are fighting it. And I think there is a great risk that we often don't pay attention to. which is the folks who control knowledge or want to control knowledge or afraid they can't and are restricting it. I believe that's what the Twitter files revealed. I think that's what COVID revealed, was that there's a great temptation for those who used to be the gatekeepers of knowledge to want to react because they no longer are those gatekeepers. They're fake news, fake news, fake news. Well, I worry not about fake news so much. I worry much more about those who say, because of fake news, we must intervene and ultimately take away rights, protest rights, information rights of individuals.
I think one of the issues that you've raised there is that the idea of protest being something that's individual versus the idea of protest as being something that's actually collective and can be controlled from all these different sources.
When we talk about rights, generally we've been talking in the notion of individual rights, guaranteed individual rights, the right to protest, the right to free expression, right? That's an individual thing. There are all kinds of collective issues, surely, but the most rights we associate with the person who can suffer or be shamed or humiliated or feel pain.
On that, and Lisa, you might be a good person to talk to this. It would be great to think about why is protest a human right and the various rights that go along with the right to protest.
Well, actually, a lot of rights spring from the right to protest, because protest can is actually about protecting and standing up for a range of things. So we can see protest around lots of different issues, whether or not it's access to health, whether or not it's fighting back against colonization, whether or not it's about your right to access education, your right to have a say in something that you might have been locked out of decision making on. There's protesters is across the board fighting for lots of different rights, and it's those rights that build the society which we can all flourish from. And so that foundational right of the right to protest is so important for upholding all the other rights.
We're talking about the importance of dissent. And so generally speaking, those with power don't want to share it. And those who don't have it have to find a way in order to address the interests that are not exactly tied to or associated with power. That's one of the reasons that often women's rights and protest have gone hand in hand. You mentioned some already, Farah did. We can go all the way back to the Greeks and Lysistrata, where the women went on a sex strike, essentially, right, in order to get the men to stop their war. So often the case of those without power is, how does one deal with power? And as I guess Lisa suggested, protest, dissent, is always something that what those who are especially individuals find that they're challenged by power structures and have to deal with them. So that's why I think we tend to side with dissenters and protesters. Because generally speaking, not universally, but generally speaking, protest is the way, or dissent is the way, to challenge power.
And just picking up on that thread that Peter's talking about there, if we look at the political context in Aotearoa, between elections, there isn't always a great deal of way we in civil society, we in communities, can influence politics in any meaningful way. And so the importance of claiming our space around the right to protest is really important, because that is a powerful way that we tell decision makers we don't agree with this, or this is important, we resist, or we want to see this, and also signal to other people in the community, hey, this is important. And so I think that framing around understanding right to protest and understanding power is really important, because when we start to see the right to protest diminished or limited, that space where community can come together to fight for what they believe in, that's incredibly, it's obviously incredibly worrying, especially worrying in a context where the power is so centralized in between elections anyway.
And just one thing to add, I mean, it is really like sad for me to see that the right to protest is being restricted in democracies as well. But the positive is that, don't worry, people will find their way to protest. Yeah, I've been there. I know that. And even the more restricted you are, as I gave you some examples, the more creative you become in finding your way out of it. I've been living in New Zealand for 11 years. I don't see people showing their dissent as much as people in an authoritarian government, in Iran, are courageous to do that. You know, in New Zealand, I'm just talking about New Zealand, I don't see people, even though people are not happy about something, they're not used to protesting. That's my experience. As much as us in the Middle East are used to it. With every little thing, we just take to the streets. But in here, you know, or maybe because, I don't know, I don't understand why it is, but maybe the more you restrict people, the more people feel this urge to go out.
That yeah. might be the answer. So yeah. Again, I think we take a risk here. I struggle when we have the wholesale murder of tens of thousands or 20 or 30 thousands of individuals who are taken to the street in Tehran. We may be seeing the chipping away of certain individual rights in democracies, and that's important. Yeah. But I don't really compare them very easily, and I don't ascribe it to, you know, Kiwis just getting along. I think there's a remarkably open democratic society we have in New Zealand. What's going on in the world where there are people who take to the streets because their lives are so circumscribed by power? Same with the United States, by the way. We can talk about Minnesota if we want. The goods and the pretties deserve us to be honest and open. Right, they gave their lives, so they deserve us to really try to understand what's happened in Minneapolis.
Yeah, I don't actually think it's helpful necessarily to compare Aotearoa to lots of different countries. I think how human rights regression happens in different countries can be very different. And one of the things we're saying is we're not necessarily saying tomorrow we're going to find an authoritarian rule. But what we are saying is if you are complacent and you put up with the continual chipping away, then you risk finding yourself in that situation. There are big human rights issues in this country. Like, we have seen an ongoing systematic attack by the government on Te Tiriti, on Indigenous rights, removing the right to vote for people in prison. And so while the human rights issues we may face here are really different from other countries, it does not mean we should tolerate that. It does not mean just because it's not as bad as another country that we should paint that as a really positive picture.
Comparison is real, though. Comparison, the comparison is important.
Yeah.
It can undermine our sense of really where we are and what our regime is. And it's natural. We should look at our own neighborhoods and find problems. But I think we really need to be grown up and have a better understanding of the world. And I think sometimes we fail that. I think we should be very smart in pointing out the problems of both regimes, left and right. And if we're just going to point out problems on what we perceive as right-wing repression, then we're completely lost. I'll give you an example. I've lived in New Zealand, Aotearoa, for 25 years, mostly, and I've never seen a greater breach of individual rights than the denial of citizens during the pandemic to return to New Zealand because there wasn't enough room in MIQ. The right of return to a country in the midst of a pandemic, to me, is the greatest travesty of rights. And Lisa, I didn't hear anybody screaming about that. Because why? Because that was the left-wing government of a prime minister we love who had a baby? I don't understand.
Well, actually, when it comes to rights not being respected across government, Peter, I think there are many examples. I think you're right. Like, I don't think it's just this government. Oh, there's lots of other examples I could give for Labor. Could be their use of urgency. It could be their expanding of terrorism laws and all the human rights issues therein. My gosh, you know, this is, if you look at, you know, our past commentary for the previous government, you'll see the litany of issues that we had with this government. So when we're talking about the chipping away at our democracy, we're not just saying it started a year ago or 2 years ago. You know, we're seeing ongoing issues. And back to the comparison point you were making, we're not in the same position necessarily as other countries. But the most important thing is we shouldn't therefore be complacent. You're right. We need a conversation about this. We need to put the cards on the table. That is absolutely what we want to see. But it is so important in doing so that we recognise, while we're not where other countries are, there is a risk if we keep allowing this chipping away with overuse of urgency, with problems getting official information when needed, et cetera, et cetera.
I think you're both making really great points. Peter, on that, it would be really great to hear about what has been happening in the States, and particularly in Minnesota. You referenced Good and Pretty.
I like mentioning them because I feel we owe something to people who have died. And maybe that has a little bit to do with Farah's notion of dancing in wakes and funerals. It's a moment where we really have to reflect, those of us who are living, what we owe to those who have died, because we're so fortunate to still be alive, and what we should do with our lives. And so when people die, what do we owe them? And I feel the discussion around understanding what's happened in Minneapolis is, I think we understand the politics, right? That the Trump administration, and maybe not Donald Trump himself, but the people he's put in charge of ICE, which is a multi-billion dollar funded enforcement agency. These folks decided, you know, Tim Walz, the governor of Minnesota, is vulnerable. And they've just had a giant scandal, a multi-billion dollar money just siphoned off from the United States and from a government that didn't understand how to spend money or how to oversee it. I mean, just an incredible scandal. So they thought, let's go into a blue state. You know what that means, right? A Democratic state with a weak governor and this scandal. And that'll be one where we'll send in ICE and we'll show them who's boss and we'll turn a blue state red. And this is going to make us a lot of hay politically. That's what they decided to do. And of course, the opposite side is equally true. So Antifa and other groups who have very much political aims decided they would go and challenge this. So not just local people, but right, just like the equivalent and opposite of ICE in some way, decided they would stop and challenge this. And how do you do that? Well, one way you do it is to disrupt. So in a sanctuary city, you make sure that the local police are banned from enforcing or protecting the federal agents and federal buildings. So then the federal agents have to be not only enforcing national law, but protecting themselves and arming themselves to defend themselves. That's already asking for trouble. Then you bring in protest. And if some of those protesters are armed and everyone around them is screaming and blowing whistles, you are explicitly intending then to disrupt and confuse armed federal agents who are cowboys. And when you do that, you're asking, in fact, you are intending to have the Sarahs and Alexes killed to make your political point. So in the United States, what's lost for a time, but is being retrieved a little bit by Tom Homan, by sending in an independent negotiator between the feds and the state, is, oh, that's right. We should remind ourselves. We are one community. We have different values ideologically, but we share something. And what we share might be safety and rights. And so we should find what we share instead of treating ICE as the enemy or immigrant communities as the enemy. When you do that, you end up in civil war. And the United States may be closer to that, that one side feels that Trump and MAGA are actually the most dangerous thing in the world. And the other side feels that the progressives and Antifa are the most dangerous thing in the world. And when in a nation, you think the most dangerous thing in the world is not Russia or China or North Korea or narco terrorism or something, but you feel it's other Americans, then you don't have an America. And I think that's maybe what we're seeing. And that's the way I take a larger nonpartisan, non-pro-Trump, non-anti-Trump view of what's going on in the United States. And I don't feel that protest really is the central issue. And maybe that's where I'm probably exceptional. I don't feel it's a matter of the right to protest that's here at all, or the right to enforce federal law, or the right to interdict national law with sanctuary cities. These are all there, but I don't think that's the nature of the issue at hand. Again, that having been said, the United States First Amendment is an extraordinary thing. The right to protest against the Vietnam War, which was an undeclared war, was so fundamental that it ended American involvement. Americans ended a war by protesting. So it's a great, remarkable thing that Americans have and cherish.
I think you make a great point. The protests that we're seeing are the reaction to much, much greater deep-seated tensions. And that's not just in the case of the US or Minnesota, but around the world, protest is a reaction to what is happening. And even in the past weeks, we've seen protests all across Australia, for example, against the visit of the Israeli president. And then something that I really like to touch on is the way that governments are then responding to these protests. And in Australia, we've seen various state governments come out and ban the slogan "From the River to the Sea" because that's associated with pro-Palestinian sentiment, and also cracking down on the right to protest. Then it's this cycle, isn't it? Reacting to the situation and then the government's reacting to the protesting.
We're certainly seeing proposals here as well that we're concerned about. There are a couple in particular that we've been concerned about. One is that the Ministry of Justice consulted on last year, which was around the definition of terrorism and what is captured. And we were really concerned how that, if that went through, although we know it's just the proposal stage, that could be problematic in capturing people that it shouldn't. But there's also, about a year ago, the Independent Police Conduct Authority handed over a proposal document to the Ministry of Justice, which is proposing to regulate protest in various different ways. The proposals in there are deeply concerning when it comes to the right to protest. But one of the things we're saying is if there is a need to regulate protest, if there are policy problems, and one of the things that the IPCA talked about was the policing of protest and uncertainty there about how to balance different rights. And if there are policy problems, then we absolutely need to work them through. But we're concerned that the proposals that are proposed aren't the way to do that and unjustifiably threaten the right. But we do need to work through policy issues, but you just need to get people around the table, particularly people impacted, to come together to think, what is the problem and what is the solution that gives everyone what they need but upholds human rights?
The outcome of protesting, that also is important. There is always maybe even a very small outcome, but there are some, I believe, good outcomes to protesting. The first and more important thing is like social awareness. For example, in New Zealand, when the Betiriti protests were happening, you know, for me as a migrant, you know, I became more aware of, you know, what exactly was happening, you know, underlying reasons for these protests. So the protests had that effect of making at least me as a migrant aware of what's been happening and why people are protesting. And whether we have the most authoritarian regimes to the democratic countries like New Zealand, I think protests will make some impact. There might not be policy changes, but they do make their own impact. You know, I personally when I saw the Toju Te Tiriti protests, I attended some of them because I realized how important it is for Aotearoa, New Zealand, and then I wanted to be part of it. I think social awareness is a very important outcome of protests, whether governments, states allow it or not, it happens.
I agree. I think that's a really important part of protest as well. It's not just about trying to influence decision making. It's also about the people around us in community and having them hear what the issues are, as you said, raising awareness. That itself is an incredibly important part of sort of the social change process and an important outcome of what comes out of protest.
Social change eventually affects regimes, I don't know, governments. Just example is the protests around removing compulsory hijab in Iran because women just wanted to have a choice. And they started from taking off their headscarves in public to burning their headscarves to those protests during the Women, Life, Freedom. And still the laws are the same. Regime has been trying to impose. I went to Iran, like, just before the recent protests. Very few people in the city of Tehran were covering their hair. I did not have to wear my headscarf. A lot of my friends, they don't even carry it with them. The law hasn't changed. But those protests, now they were so immense that they sometimes, I mean, regimes find themselves helpless. They can't do anything about it. You know, they have to just allow people to do what they want to do. So that's the power of protests. You know, none of the policies changed. Everything still says that hijab is compulsory. Only at schools, universities, and government departments people are covering. Nowhere else.
Why still at universities? That seems to me such an interesting note.
Yeah,
because what is that about?
Because universities, they are like, it's imposed because there's like more enforcement there. University students don't want to do it. But it's just, they just have to, when they enter, there are people who, but still in universities, the students, anytime they can, they unveil themselves. But the thing is, when you see a woman with hijab, you say, oh yeah, it's the women in hijab are the minorities. But the thing is, you know, as I said, the good news is change will happen, whether they want it or not. Cultural change will happen. It has cultural impact, although in the long run, but these protests eventually work.
I confess, I don't know the arc of history. I struggle as an historian looking forward and thinking there is an arc, or in the long run. I hope so. I confess, I just don't know. Sally, the focus of this program reminds me that I always tend, first of all, only to criticize myself. So I'm in the university. I come from a progressive left family. So I mostly leave to others to criticize, you know, gun-loving Alabaman racists or something because I'm not one of them. But being part of the university, being part of a left circle, though obviously the regime is controlling the universities in Iran, so I wouldn't agree with that being left circle, so I'm not saying that. I think this is a great opportunity for left and right to find common cause. And I feel this is something where, again, we're played with and baited. And I'm for individuals resisting, which is using their brain, developing their brains, not depending on others or just swallowing what they see or hear, but critiquing it, taking it on themselves to understand. And when we do that, we have an opportunity to unify left and right against regimes and against those who we think are opposites, left and right, in power. But in fact, they eat together. They share power, left and right, and they gaslight us in thinking that really the fight is between the left and the right among us, and finding commonality on both sides or opposite sides of a kind of ideological spectrum is where people gain power. And so I think it's really incumbent upon us to look and see that I may feel that From the River to the Sea is a kind of genocidal wish. I may not, but I believe the Australian government has no more right to restrict that than I feel that we should restrict, oh, speech about dead naming people online or whatever the UK is doing in articulating hate speech. I think both are equally wrong. And this is where those of us in favor of grassroots rejection of our gaslighting can make some real progress, left and right. That's what we should do. Instead of being on opposite sides, the protesters, the Palestinian protesters, on opposite sides of those who are maybe protesting other things, can agree on the right to speak as long as you are not physically harming others. I resist the notion of speech acts being violence. I resist that. I find that that's a mistake we're making on the left that's not enabling us to unify with some of those on the right and see the commonality for the defense of individual rights, rights to protest, rights to free speech, rights to free thinking.
Just one comment in regards to like the protests not becoming violent. Yeah, usually protesters, they take to the street because they want to peacefully solve issues. When the state starts violence, you know, it's like a self-defense. Sometimes protests become violent because people want to defend themselves. But, you know, in my, as I say, my experience, people in Iran, they are they're unarmed and they had nothing to defend themselves. But the only thing they could do was like, I don't know, burning big rubbish bins. There are like metal rubbish bins where people put the rubbish and then the city collects them. They just burned those metal rubbish bins in order to, for example, fight the tear gas or things. But sometimes they need to defend themselves. That's when sometimes protests might become a bit violent, just as response to violence.
You bring up a very interesting point in understanding that we don't know where things will go. Mm. And the aims of protests are not clear, but they're always and should be mixed. And so if part of the aim is to provoke those in power to demonstrate their power, then those willing to suffer and risk violence, being unarmed against a regime, are heroes. That still doesn't mean we don't want to be honest and say their aim often might be to provoke regimes into violence. So this is exactly what I would say happened in Minneapolis. Is let's just not get too upset, alas, about killing two people. We feel for them, but this is the aim of the protesters, is to, in part, is to provoke regimes to demonstrate their violent proclivities, and we to treat them as heroes, not just because they're seeking self-defense, which is natural, but also because they're attempting to show the world what a regime is willing to do. I just think we always have to be honest with ourselves then and say, well, we can understand then that we can't always just mourn death. This is what the folks are doing. They're stepping into the mouth of the dragon on purpose. And we can understand both, can't we? We can be subtle enough to understand both, that we can treat them as heroes and yet understand that the movement might be trying to provoke violence. Those are both, right? We're sophisticated enough, aren't we, to see both often?
I think in doing so, it's always important to come back to when regimes show themselves, when they show their use of violence in a way that is not right, then particularly for us, when we're watching around the world, we're watching you know, brave people, as people have said, put their bodies on the line. It's so incumbent on us to help keep the light on that and to keep calling it out and saying, this isn't right. One of the things I was thinking about, Whara, just when you were talking earlier about the protest, is the role that persistence of protest is so important. And I know people said it feels daunting, because often when you're thinking of social change, it can be over decades and a long time. And so it's that persistence of keeping on going and thinking long-term versus short-term is so important. And even when it might feel like nothing's happening, actually things are. And that's why it's so important that, you know, when we're seeing the horrific violence by different regimes, by government actors, that it might seem small, but helping to keep the spotlight on is so important, and so important for solidarity for those that are putting their bodies on the line.
And I think building on that, this idea of violence and putting your body on the line, killing is obviously the most extreme example of that, but there are other ways of putting your body on the line. Thinking about arrests, for example, the thousands of people arrested in Iran following the protests, they haven't been killed, but they are in prison or they are incarcerated somewhere.
In the queue for execution as well.
Yeah. And people being arrested in other countries for other kinds of protests, whether that's publishing, for example, Jimmy Lai arrested in Hong Kong, publishing information that wasn't what the Chinese government wanted him to be publishing.
And the family being convicted, by the way, right? That's the shocking next turn, is the family publicly convicted this week for the father's transgressions.
Exactly. That's exactly what happens in authoritarian governments. They always pursue the family members, like people's children, husbands, wives, mothers, fathers. Yeah.
Again, contrast, right? In the United States, in New Zealand, to say that doesn't happen would be a silly overstatement, but it's fundamentally against both the political culture, the legal culture, and the popular culture. It's a difficult, all these questions, isn't it? I hate to be literary, but you have to live with me. Alexander Solzhenitsyn, a great protester, had a book called The First Circle, in which Stalin had scientific experts stuck in, I guess, the first circle of hell, but an apartment building in Moscow. And he was there because they had to produce for him, or that he killed him, a way of when people called on the phone to understand who's useless. That's a great winter and control. Well, we live in the first circle now, right? That every click we make on our computer, everywhere we go with our phone, the surveillance state now, if it wants to, can track it. And so we are in a time where regimes can decide how valuable you are or danger you are to them, to the regime. They can act on that knowledge and information. We are in a state where the right of individuals to think, much less to speak and to write and to protest, we're in a new world in that sense, because now Stalin's dreams are realized exponentially.
Yeah, I agree with Peter. I mean, like, protest has always been important, resistance, but that is a unique part of the time that we're part of now, with technology, with that 24-hour surveillance. All of that creates a whole new environment when it comes to protesting, facial recognition technology, and how that's played out and used in different states when it comes to protesters and identifying protesters. It was absolutely one of the key challenges for this time.
My wife and I, we have three children. Actually, they're their own people. We just sort of loved them with detachment for a few years while we're raising them. And so our advice to them, I'm not sure what yours are to your children, has always been live a noble life and assume that everything that gets digitized about you is public. Just assume that. And that's a hard thing. It's a very hard thing to raise children without much privacy, or as Lisa said, without a chance to think that something they do that is digitized will haunt them with their friends or with their government or with the regime or with their entire future.
I've got children too, although younger children, so we're only beginning to enter that that conversation at the moment. And it is so hard for young people. I mean, it's hard for me to grasp as an adult, but particularly young people when you're talking about the future, you know, and as a young person, you might be thinking about tomorrow or you know, the next day, but that, you know, the there forever thing and not knowing what's around the corner and how this stuff will be used and all of that. It is so much to grasp. But I think this is where, and it's happening around different countries, but we need a big conversation about how we deal with AI in this country on an ongoing basis too, because obviously this technology just keeps evolving. It's not something that you can just understand today and obviously that's it. And so how we as a society are developing our own norms around it, but we also need to be having that conversation about what does that mean for laws of privacy, all of those different areas, and those wheels are turning. But it really does need to be a national conversation.
This sort of future focus seems like a really good place to try and start wrapping things up. As we get into our final few minutes, it would be nice to hear from you where you'd like to see us heading, perhaps, and how we might get there, particularly in this current context where we're facing authoritarian creep. We've got this technology. There's a lot of challenges to human rights, including the right to protest.
I'm a teacher and a parent, and that makes me have to be an optimist. But I am by nature. So I look at young people, women, men, non-binary, in Iran, and it makes me hopeful. It does. It makes me hopeful that folks want things. Now, whether they just want more water or more than $7 a month or whatever was promised, I'm sure it's true because people don't live by, I'm not sure I'd like to use a Persian word, but bread alone. They live by ideas too and meaning in life. And I'm always inspired. Finally, I have faith in people. I do. I believe in jury of your peers. I believe that local communities, while there is such a thing as village totalitarianism for sure, the mistakes individuals will make and do make, every human heart has good and bad in it. I have basic faith that people can decide and should decide for themselves, whether they want to protest, whether they want to risk themselves, whether they believe or can live with the regime or not. And to decide for themselves what's news and what's fake news and what's AI generated and what isn't. I think when we lose faith in that and we want institutions to decide for us what's fake news or to tell us what's not acceptable or how you can't talk about COVID or can't say don't vaccinate, as soon as you say these things, which of course the left seems to want to say most, I think we're losing the plot because we're lying if we think we're against regimes and yet we want the regime to keep people from being anti-vaxxers or anti-science or anti-this. You got to live with that. People are going to make ideological mistakes. It's what we are, and there is nothing other than people to help us mediate people.
It's good to bring it beyond partisan politics, I think.
It's essential. We're being gaslit, in my humble view. And I trust people to see through it, but especially us, the chattering classes. You know, let's not be tempted to blame someone other than us who doesn't have power.
So I am an optimist too, and I do believe in the power of people. And I agree with you, Peter, that you know human beings should be allowed and should be able to judge for themselves whether something is misinformation or not. So no one should be allowed to limit their access to any information. And the good thing about social media is that it's giving us human beings power to tell the truth, to lie, to do whatever we want to do, regardless of what the like big media are saying. So I really like social media because it's giving me as a single person, human being, some power to express myself, hoping, you know, it will not be censored. And I also believe that us, again, as individuals, as human beings, we should just continue to promote social awareness. That's all we can do. I mean, I don't have power to make changes to the policies, but at least I can just continue to talk to people, to promote social awareness. That's all I can do. And I also believe that, again, us human beings, if we show solidarity for each other, you know, even if it's in another part of the world, I think we will eventually be able to make some changes. And whether it is in New Zealand, the US, the Middle East, Palestine, Iran, we should continue to believe that the right to protest is our human rights, and we should continue to challenge power.
Well, I'll carry on the theme because I too am optimistic. I agree. And in fact, it's something you were saying earlier on. You were talking about the power of protest and how it works. And it does work. And it can take time, but it does work. We've just seen that time and time again through lots of different social movements, lots of different places. And it can seem daunting. It can seem like nothing is happening, but it is. And you know, we all stand on the shoulders of, and continue to do so, some amazing protesters from the past, and as we were talking about earlier, right now, around the world, and really want to acknowledge that bravery across the world. And so I really am optimistic. We all want societies where we can all thrive, you know, that basic humanity within us. And when that is really challenged, we do see people coming out to fight for what's right. And so I am optimistic with you all about where we're going. And if people are wanting to take action around the right to protest in Aotearoa or some of the other topics we've talked about around online harm, and to find out more about that, there is stuff on the Amnesty website, so people can head over there. But would really encourage people, you know, when we're looking at all of these trends around human rights regression, authoritarianism, you know, one of the best ways to push back against that is a strong civil society, no matter what that participation looks like to you, whether or not it's with an organisation, within your workplace, doing something locally, that participation is gold, and really encourage people to continue that. Thank you.
I think that's one thing I would reiterate as well, is that we touched on it right at the start, but protest is not just getting out on the street, waving a placard. Protest can take a lot of different forms. And if people are thinking about the change they might like to see, then thinking about how protest might work for them and what ways that they might enact protest themselves.
That's right. Yeah.
Tēnā koutou. Thank you all so much. You've come from such different perspectives on this, but we all ended up much at the same space, in that space of optimism, which was really nice to hear. I certainly feel quite emotional when I think about people putting their lives on the line to try and do what they think is the right thing for future generations. It's a long-term game. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lisa.
Thank you, Sally.
Thank you, Riley.